I just learned something. Oh, something. From the purpose of these things to be so let's see what we have tonight. So. Okay, number one, can we do exercises on Tai Chi during your retreat? You can do anything you want, yeah. I'm not a policeman, I'm not going to tell you what to do there. You can, as far as I'm concerned, I think Tai Chi is quite useful. It's very useful to do Tai Chi, so I think it's great. Sometimes people even want to go for runs during the retreat. I've happened before, can I go for a run during the retreat? Really, because, you know, as far as I'm concerned, people can do whatever they like, and they can kind of figure out for themselves what works and what doesn't work. Because different things work for different people. You want to do Tai Chi? Please do so. Please don't do any. There's a few things you should avoid, like wrestling or judo, that kind of stuff. You know that. Apart from that, you can do almost anything you like. Yeah. So that's great. Especially peaceful things like Tai Chi. You know, it's a very good idea. Okay. Thank you for your hard work. How do you guys keep celibacy, especially for young men? Is it against nature? I find that young men think about sex all the time. Not all the time, but I think that's probably an exaggeration. Sometimes it can be hard, sometimes not. It really depends. People are very different. Yeah? It really, some people, for some people it's very difficult, for some people it's not. So it really depends on your mind state, and it depends on how developed your mind is. If you have a developed mind, like, you know, you're already, your vacation is going quite well, and all this, it is not that difficult. But if your mind is not developed, and you get all your happiness through sensual pleasure, of course, then it's going to be much more difficult. So it depends on your development of the mind, it also depends on your commitment to Buddhism, yeah? How much faith have you got in the Buddhist teachings? If you really believe that the Buddhist teaching, that this is it, this is the meaning of life, then you're able to kind of endure difficult periods when you kind of, you know, you feel like disrobing or whatever in there. You're able to endure that because the overall picture, the service provider has my, thank you so much. Apologies, okay, great, that's the most kind of you. Very nice to remind you, all these nice things happen to you. It's great. This is one of the advantages of being a monk. It will be very nice to meet you. So if you have a strong commitment to the Buddhist teaching, then you are convinced that this is really what it's all about. That of course, you're able to deal with more difficult periods. This is not the only thing. There's also other things like, you know, not maybe enjoying the monastic community. Sometimes you start out in the wrong place, you have the wrong kind of spiritual friends. And sometimes you need quite a strong commitment to be able to carry through, get better advice perhaps, and all of these kinds of things. So it really depends on all of these things. If you have doubts about whether you will be able to live this monastic life, but you're interested in it, the best thing to do is to try it out. Yeah, try out monastic life for a while and see if it works for you. For some people, they just can't do it, and then they return back to their life again. Other people, it is more natural, and more happens naturally. That is often the best way to go about things. Rather commit yourself for life straight away. As if you're going to do this for life, so that on the first day. Those people who say that, they're usually the ones who don't make it. Yeah, it's true. But those people are a bit more realistic. Yeah, let's see how things go. Maybe I will make it, maybe I won't, but you know, let's give it a shot. That's what I said about running. I said, actually, well, I'm sure, you know, it's uncertain. I can kind of make a commitment for a year. Beyond that, uncertain. And he said, okay, no problem, sir. And I'm still here. Yeah, so I'm 23 years. Now I feel a lot more certain about it than I did when I started out. So that's kind of a good thing in that, I think. Okay, so I hope that helps, sir. Okay, next one. Apart from the apart from samadhi state when you are non-self. Any other examples, sir? Okay, so this is one of the main ways that you understand non-self, it's not so much the actual state of samadhi, but you see things disappearing as you go through the process. Yeah, this is what, the deeper the samadhi is, the more things have disappeared, the less is left of the five khandhas. The five khandhas is our experience, our experiential world is the five khandhas. Everything you feel now, everything you experience right now, is the five khandhas. As you go through the state of anapanasati, as your meditation goes deeper and deeper, the less there is left of the five khandhas. The five khandhas are basically disappearing. That's what's going on in samadhi. Your body starts to disappear, your senses starts to disappear, various types of feeling disappear, there's only happiness left. Perceptions become simpler and simpler, there's less and less left of the perceptions. So the will is starting to disappear. Yeah, when the mind becomes very still, that's the will disappearing. There's no movement left. Consciousness starts to disappear, moving on just for the mind consciousness. So the deeper you go in samadhi, the more you have purely of, you know, the less there is of the five khandhas. Those parts of the five khandhas are not gone, because they are completely gone. If you really have renounced them completely, as you have to do in the samadhi, they cannot be self. They cannot be self because they are renounced. They are gone. The body is completely gone, as if you never had it, and as if you never need it again. The will, similar kind of thing, yeah? This is how you start to understand non-self. There are other ways as well to see non-self. You can see non-self, for example, and if you start to contemplate the world and see how much effect you have on the world around you, you start to see that your ability to control the world is quite limited. You can only control so much. Yeah? And this is because the feeling that we have inside of control actually is an illusion. You try to control your family, you think you're going to make things go one way, but actually you can't very often. And that is because a lot of people, there's a very powerful sense of illusion, this illusion that we are in charge of our lives and we can control it. The more you understand how the world is built up out of causes and conditions, things coming together that have got nothing to do with you, the more you understand it's out of your control. It is non-self, basically. Same thing with you. If you look at yourself very carefully, yeah, you look at your body, you look at your mind, and you see how it is, just by contemplating how your mind works, you can see that it is basically the sum total of causes and conditions that have worked on you in this life and in past lives. You can see that, and the more you see that, the more you are able to accept yourself for what you are. This is who I am. This is the reason I'm like this, because you know, these are the causes and conditions. They can't really be any different. And then when you get angry or defilements arise in your mind, you accept yourself. Okay, I'm like this because of causes and conditions. Why get upset with myself? Instead, you have compassion for yourself because you are, in a sense, the victim of the past conditioning. Yeah? Now I'm getting upset again. Why am I getting upset? I don't want to be upset. It's past conditioning. Oh, you feel kind of compassionate for yourself because you don't really want to be there. But sometimes you have no choice. Anger just arises, even whether you want to or not, and you can't stop yourself. But yes, you have compassion for yourself because there's nothing much you can do about it. This is a very simple way of dealing with defilements and dealing with problems. Because then you start accepting yourself. It's like having a sense of self-love. Yeah? And as it says in one of the sutras, who do we love most of all? We want ourselves. Because nobody is closer to us than ourselves. So if you can increase that sense of self-love, it's actually very useful. If you love yourself in the right way, you also have love and time for others. You're basically the same thing. Yeah, in metta, we're trying to have metta for the whole universe. You are included. All beings are included. So that appropriate sense of self-esteem also leads to acceptance of others as well. Yeah, so you see yourself, you understand. No control, no self. I am who I am because of past conditions, nothing else. There's another way of seeing this. The deeper you go into meditation, the more ability you have to see that everything is created in this way. And when you see that things are created in this way, through cause and conditions, the more you contemplate that, the more non-self, the whole experience becomes. Images and voices are these part of Dhamma Vipassana. in which is an oasis, that is part of Dhamma Vipassana. Dhamma Vipassana, the main thing of Dhamma Vipassana is about understanding the defilements of the mind. Yeah? Dhamma Vipassana is about understanding the five hindrances. So the Dhamma Vipassana says you understand each of the five hindrances in terms of its presence or absence, in terms of what causes it, in terms of how you abandon it, and in terms of how it remains abandoned in the future. Yeah, this is basically Dhamma Vipassana. It's about causality. And Dhamma Vipassana, I think a good translation of it is the contemplation of principles. Principles means principles of causality. What if we're the teaching of causality? Things arise, things exist because of cause and conditions. Dukkha exists because of cause and conditions. Liberation exists because of cause and conditions. Every defilement of the mind is there because of the cause, and that is why it can be overcome. So, in Dhamma Vipassana, you are actually contemplating the defilements so as to enable you to overcome them completely. Remember, the defilements are very subtle. One thing is like gross anger or gross desire. Yeah, you feel it straight away. This is gross anger or desire. Yes, you know what it is. But the defilements go to very, very subtle levels. Like slight dullness of the mind, slight restlessness of the mind. Yeah, there's the tiny movement of the mind is restlessness. A tiny bit of dullness. I mean, the nimitta isn't as bright as it should be. Then you think, wow, this is so much bliss, but actually, the bliss needs to be even more powerful to be able to take you into a Dharma center. These tiny little defilements are the things that you understand in Dhamma Vipassana, and you understand the causality behind it. Also, the seven factors of awakening are part of Dhamma Vipassana. Yeah? And seven factors of awakening are the opposite, the antidote to the five hindrances. And they are the Sati Sambuddhanga, Dhammavicaya Sambuddhanga, Virya Sambuddhanga, Pitta Sambuddhanga, Asati Sambuddhanga, Samadhi Sambuddhanga, and Upekkha Sambuddhanga. Yeah, the mindfulness, investigation of phenomena, energy, rapture, Asati, calm, tranquility, stillness of the mind, and equanimity are the last one. The seven Sambuddhangas, and these also arise across the course and conditions. So you understand what that spiritual faculty is, what the awakening faculty is, you understand how it comes about, and you understand how it remains established. Yeah? And these two are the two main aspects of Dhamma Vipassana. This is the interesting thing about the Satipatthana Sutta. I mean, if you study it in detail, there are some very nice studies on this. One of them is my good friend Ajahn Sujata. Yeah, he had done a big study of the Satipatthana Sutta and concluded through comparative study, through all kinds of things, that the two original, most authentic contemplations of Dhamma Vipassana are the contemplation of the five hindrances and the contemplation of the seven factors of awakening. So those are the ones that I would focus on. Those are the most important ones. So images and voices are the part of Dhamma Vipassana. I'm not sure exactly what you mean by that. What I have just been telling you now is what I think about the most important things.
Very evil things are from the seasons of the Shiva, the
sort of
sense spaces,
the sense spaces, yeah. So this is the thing that the Dhamma Vipassana, you know, you have the six sense stages, and then you have the five aggregates, and then you have the four noble truths, yeah? All of these various kind of things are actually part of it in the Satipatthana Sutta. But I think, I prefer to simplify that whole thing and say that the main aspect of this is the five hindrances and the seven factors of awakening. That's what I focus on when I think of Dhamma Vipassana. Because it fits in with the whole flow of the Satipatthana, which to me is to take the mind to samadhi. And the very last step that we need to take the mind to samadhi is to eliminate the five hindrances altogether and build up the factors of awakening, the piti, all of the things that lead to samadhi. That is my focus. Once you talk about the six sense plays and all of this, you are starting to move into the territory of, especially the five aggregates, you know, the territory of deep insight very often. You can use it at this point as well, but I would say that is better done after you come out of samadhi with those aspects of it. But the thing is that, you know, Satipatthana itself also includes samadhi. If you looked very careful at the Satipatthana Sutra, you look at the Vedana Vipassana, unconditional feelings, for example, it has things like Niramisa Vedana. Yeah? Niramisa Sukha, rather. Yeah? And Niramisa means, in English, you can translate it as literally non-carnal happiness. Amisa in Pali means flesh. Nira means without, so it's like non-carnal. So this is the spiritual happiness. And it is defined in the sutta as the four jhanas. If you go to the Chitta Vipassana, very similar kind of thing. I don't want to go into too much detail about this because this is not discussed with the Satipatthana Sutta, which takes a long time and it's good fun. And I did it last time. Next time I come, we can have a careful study of the Satipatthana Sutta. Actually, a very interesting thing to do. But also in the Chitta Vipassana, we have all these factors of contemplation of the Chitta, which all are about states of samadhi. Yeah, the mahagatna chitta, the mind gone large, the apamana is not there, the, what is it, vimutta chitta, I think is in there, the anuttara chitta, unsurpassed mind, and all of these things refer to samadhi states. So in one sense, samadhi is included within Satipatthana when you look at the larger framework. In another sense, samadhi is a cause that leads you to samadhi. Yeah? So it's a little bit kind of interwoven in a sense, these things. But anyway, that is the main way that I tend to look at these things. So that's why I tend to limit the discussion of Satipatthana to those factors. Okay. Okay, let's have a quick look here, maybe a bit this past here. So let's see. Vyaja, is meditation meant to be cathartic? Is there a minimum presence, is there a numinous presence during meditation? So is it cathartic? In other words, cathartic means cleansing, basically, doesn't it? That's what catharsis means, the cleansing of the mind, the cleansing of the body. Is it cathartic? Sure it is, yes, very, very cathartic, yeah, everything. You get rid of all the bad stuff, you get all the good stuff. So it's kind of a super, super, super cathartic. And it also, and maybe what you mean here is like traumas perhaps from the past, yeah, because you actually have a sense of clearing out those traumas from the past. And yes, it does in the end, yeah. It has that because you are tapping into something else that is far more profound and far more meaningful. And after a while, any trauma, any problems from the past actually tend to fade as a consequence. So it is actually very cathartic, it's a very purifying thing. The more happiness you have, the more joy you produce in meditation, the more past things that seem to kind of evaporate, they don't mean so much anymore. And you start to see the past through new eyes. Yeah? It's one of those wonderful things. The past looks different. Things that previously you complained about and were bad, suddenly they're not no issue anymore. And you start to be able to have compassion and kindness for people you may have felt were very difficult in your life in the past. Yeah, so that is a wonderful process. It's part of this process we were talking about the other day about the simile of the lump of salt in the suttas. We have the same lump of salt, which is your bad karma, the bad things of the past. Put it in a small cup of glass of water, very salty. Put it in a large pond, you can't barely taste it anymore. Yeah. This is true of everything. Yeah, bad karma, bad experience, everything. Yeah. The large that pond, that pool of good karma. So create what's good karma, large pool, yeah, like a river of good karma. And as you do that, the bad karma kind of dissipates, it dissolves, and it's no longer a problem. It's a very nice process, and you will see this catharsis happening as a consequence of that. But definitely cathartic. And yeah, but also the other thing about, you know, the meditation practice and the development of the mind is that we learn directly, immediately, how to look at the past with new eyes. You learn about, and of course, conditionality is one of the very important aspects of this. Once you start to see that other people are acting in ways because of their conditioning, because of the way they have experienced the world, it becomes much more easy to forgive them. Yeah, even if they have treated you badly, you are actually nothing to do with you. It's their problem. Yeah, they did these bad things. Even if it is family members, you can start to forgive them because of these things. And gradually the past kind of disappears into the background because you forgive, you let go, you start to understand the nature of these things. Very often the reason why the past is so painful is because very often it feels so personal. They did something bad towards me, and it's a very personal feeling. And then it's particularly difficult to bear. But if you depersonalize it, if it is nothing to do between you, them, and you, but actually it's they are only playing out their own inner conditioning, their own program, something's got nothing to do with you anymore. It's just the way they happen to be. Yeah, you decouple the personal aspect of it. It's all impersonal. It's far easier to deal with in this way. Yeah? So the whole process is one of that. And that's why very often, you know, sure, if you are very kind of, if you have lots of problems, it might be nice for us to see a psychologist or a psychiatrist and say, please, you know, I need some good advice on overcoming these things. And sometimes that can be useful. And there's no reason why people should not see a psychiatrist when they have, you know, some serious problem. Especially if they have, you know, real mental health things like psychosis or deep depression, all these kind of things. But if you are able to deal with it roughly, then the path of practice, you know, of living a good, wholesome Buddhist life will take care of so many of the other problems in your life. Is there a luminous presence during meditation? So luminous is like a kind of a spiritual presence, yeah? Some kind of higher presence is presumably what you mean by that. Is there such a presence during meditation? And you are your own luminous presence, yeah? Isn't the nice thing about this? You create that luminous presence through your meditation practice. It's in your mind, yeah? Don't worry about whether there's anything else for it. That kind of irrelevant. Maybe there is, maybe there isn't. But that doesn't matter then. You create that luminous presence. So when you tap into a little bit of metta, when you start to feel the joy of that, when you feel that your mind is brightening up, that is the luminous presence. Yeah. This is kind of the, that is the kind of the spiritual, the real spiritual Buddhist aspects kind of growing inside of you. Yeah, and that is sufficient. And I think that is what really you should look for, rather than anything else. And if you look for anything beyond that, then you're on the right track. Luminous. Yeah, anyway. Okay. So, at one point while meditating, I felt being slowly pulled towards something that that seemed like a vast dark space. Look at the vast dark space. I sensed that sensation. Should I have given in? I should have given that. This is common experience. Okay, so you basically didn't want that sensation, is probably what you're saying. Should I have given in instead? I resisted that sensation, that's what you're saying, yeah. It really depends. Yeah, is it common? Yes, it is quite common. I've heard many people having this kind of things before. It depends on the situation, that what that vast darkness actually is. And in meditation, the mind creates all kinds of perceptions. And the way to know whether that perception is useful or not is to understand how you feel at that particular time. And if you feel a bit dark, you feel a bit negative, you feel a bit confused, it doesn't feel right, yeah? Then be careful with anything in meditation, including dark spaces, because your mind is not in the right spot. Sometimes people feel really, really confused, really all over the place, and heading in the wrong direction. Some people have bad experiences with meditation. Yeah, it happens. It's not the majority, it's only a small minority, but it happens. If you feel things are going in the wrong way, don't follow that path. Don't go there. Don't just say, I will note what is happening. Because you can get yourself into difficulty. And these difficulties can become problematic for a long time if you follow in this way. So know your mind state. But if you are kind of mindful, you are at ease, you are relaxed, you don't feel any kind of anger or confusion or anything like that, then there's probably nothing to worry about. And you can kind of move towards that. But notice your reaction, yeah? If it brings about a lot of discomfort or whatever, or even something which isn't right about it, then don't go there. Yeah? Make sure you're comfortable about this. And this is always such an important thing. So I cannot really tell you whether you should have what is the right approach. You have to know for yourself, and you have to base it on these basic principles. If it feels right or not, that is really what it is about. And yes, it is quite common. So every experience you have, somebody else had before you. Yeah, it's terrible, isn't it? There's nothing special about that stuff. Yeah, it's just everybody had it before. Wow, that's been such a downer. Everybody wants to be special now. And anyway, okay, let's go on to the next one. Number one, why don't Ramana Vision emphasize on emptiness? Two, does infinite affect our minds? As well as these, do you still use infinite, etc.? Why don't Theravada tradition emphasize that? Well, it does sometimes, yeah? You read the suttas, and the Buddha sometimes talks about emptiness, and sunyata. What does it mean? The meaning sometimes is slightly different in Theravada compared to Mahayana. So Theravada talks about emptiness, and Theravada means that the Buddha says the world is empty of the self. And what belongs to itself. Yeah, that is emptiness of Theravada Buddhism. So, and that is what it means, really. But in some Mahayana Buddhists, they go further than that, and they say all phenomena are empty of any inherent essence, yeah, including kind of this external. This here, this cushion, is empty of inherent essence, yeah? Maybe it's so, but it's kind of from a Theravada perspective, it's kind of irrelevant, but maybe it's empty of that, probably is actually, but it's not the thing that needs to be focused on. The thing that needs to be focused on is our own immediate experience. Actually, this is part of our experience anyway, so it doesn't make much difference, but what is your experience like? Is your experience empty of the self or not? The five khandhas. Yeah, that is what it's really all about. So you look inside of yourself, and you see, and then you find out, all empty. That's what you find out. That's the Theravada approach. It is also what the Mahayana do as well, by the way. At least some of them know. And also only some of the Theravada. Sometimes we think that, what is right? Is it Theravada that is right, or is Mahayana right? And often this is the wrong question. Because it's not as if one is right and the other one is wrong. Sometimes you may find Mahayana practitioners who practice in a way that is very similar to the early Buddhist teachings. And then they are right. Sometimes you find Theravada Buddhists who are practicing really weakly. Then they are wrong. Yeah? So it's not Theravada or Mahayana. It is how you practice. Do we practice in accordance with the early Buddhist teachings? That is what matters. Those early Buddhist teachings are, to a large extent, they are also available in Mahayana. They are available in Theravada. But very few Theravadins, very few Mahayana people actually practice according to that, at least in a pure way. And that's why it is problematic. So you can't really separate the world quite like that, Theravada and Mahayana, one being right, one being wrong. It really depends on the individual and how they approach these teachings. I would say the best thing to do is to be a follower of the Buddha. Yeah, don't be a follower of the late and the old Buddha teacher. Be a follower of the Buddha, and you can't go wrong. That is really the ideal, I think. Does the internet affect your mind? Well, what do you think? It does. It's kind of pretty obvious. You use the internet too much. How do you feel? You feel really tired, really exhausted by spending too much time on the internet. Of course, then there's all the weeds now from the internet that also affects your mind. Yeah. So, as monastics, do you still use internet? Yes, sometimes I use the internet. I use it very much for communication, just for email and that sort of thing. Even now when I'm here, I send quite a few emails because I just have to continue with things. I don't consider this as a full retreat for myself as I would at ordinary monastery. So I also still use the internet a bit. And there are some very good, interesting websites out there. In websites like Sutta Central, if you want access to the whole Pali Canon in all various languages with the translation software and all that, the internet is really good. Yeah, and way in. I just said you weren't able to access the translation faculty for translating the Pali into English. That's what you said.
I can't get into the Pali.
Yeah, I can. I can show you afterwards. I have to do it. Yeah, I was able to do it there. So after I spoke to me, I checked it out and I was able to access it. So I'll show you how to do access. Yeah, there. That's why it's so good. And this website, this is super central. You go to the Pali text. Yeah, it looks like gobbledygook when you see it. Maybe you can recognize if you were Dukkha here, Sukha there, Anatta here. Yeah, so it's nice to see that. But generally, you can't read it. So, the social media is so powerful. You turn on the dictionary, you hover your cursor over a particular word, and it tells you the meaning of that word. Yeah, this is super central for you. Yeah. So, really good. So, you can open the English text on one side, you can have the Pali text, and then you can use the cursor to hover over it to see the translations. Or if you prefer to read it in Chinese, I think you can read it in modern Chinese characters as well. Yeah, in Chinese, if you want to read it in Arabic, you can read it in Arabic. If you want to read it in Norwegian translation, in Norwegian translations. I don't like Norwegian, I prefer English myself. So it's all there. This is why the internet sometimes is useful, because there are things there that are, you know, very relatable to our lives. But of course, be careful. The problem with the internet is also there's so much dodgy information out there. So make sure you go to those places where you get information that is suitable. After a while, you build up the sense for where the good information is available, and you go, you kind of follow that instead of kind of reading random stuff all over the place. And after a while, you don't know up from down, left from right, and you kind of wander around in a dark cloud, and you feel really confused about everything. So use the internet wisely. Yeah, and when you do that, then it can be a very helpful tool. Otherwise, it'd be very, very useless. And one of the things that you know, you recognize after a while is also how much it depletes your energy if you use the internet too much. One of the interesting things you see some of the kind of people who are closest to the technology scene. I have a very good friend of mine who was a CEO of a large software company in the US. He was Norwegian by birth, but he moved over there. He was the CEO of this company, and he said that to his kids, you know, all internet devices are kind of cut off at least an hour or two before they go to bed at night. And this is interesting. It's not just him, but all the top CEOs, the top people in the tech industry in the US, this is what they do. Like Steve Jobs did that with his children, because they understand the kind of bad effect it has on you to use the internet until the very last moment when you go to bed. Yeah, and you sleep badly. You wake up in the middle of the night, all these kind of things, because you use the internet too much. So a little bit of self-discipline is so important. But how many people have that self-discipline? Very few. What is it? I read some amazing statistics in the recently about internet usage. There was something like 90% of people, it was incredibly high. The last thing they do at night before they go to bed is kind of check their mobile phone, whatever it is. I'm not sure what they're checking, Facebook or email. Facebook is getting a really bad rap these days. So maybe that's just... And the first thing they do in the morning is to check kind of their mobile phone again. Yeah, what's happening? This is why. This is when it becomes a problem. And that is good to have somewhere you can lock away your phone. Yeah, lock away your internet device downstairs in the cabinet, and then it only opens up again in the morning after a certain time. At least you can get a good night's sleep. You can do a bit of meditation before you go to bed. I don't know if anyone here is like that. I'm sure there's someone here like that, because people generally seem to be like that these days. So try to come off those devices a bit later, and I think that will actually enhance the quality of your life massively. I read a story recently, and sometimes I like to read some news stories as well. And this was a news story about a man. This was in the US, and he was so disgusted when Donald Trump became the president in the US. He was just absolutely up in arms. He didn't know what to do. He was really, really upset, and he just couldn't get over it. And he decided, from now on, I'm not going to read any more news. So he blacked out all news. He moved to this farm, and he didn't use the internet, didn't use nothing, didn't have a TV, no newspapers, nothing. When he met his friends, they weren't allowed to talk about what's happening in the world, They just talked about, the trees are beautiful, the birds are singing, that kind of stuff. And he said he felt so free, he felt so liberated after a while. What do you need to know all the news for anyway? It's like we feel we have to know all this stuff. Actually, we don't have to know all of this stuff. And he had a much better life after cutting out all the news than he had beforehand. It's quite a cool story. He was just an ordinary guy, an ordinary fellow. But for people who have a Dhamma practice, who have a meditation practice, actually, it might be even more powerful. You cut all that away, and suddenly you may find that your meditation, all these things, actually blossom much more, because you're cutting away all the nonsense in the world that you don't even need to know about as well. So maybe I should also read this news. Sometimes when I read too much news, I'll get to this good point. I thought that was very, very fascinating. Yeah. And then you have, because sometimes we just don't know how these things influence us. Can have bad effects. Because the news, let's face it, what is it? It's the worst event that happened all the way around the world. Packed into 20 minutes or half an hour if it's on TV. You're packed into the newspaper. It's always the bad stuff, yeah? And you're feeling all these bad things day after day after day, all the time. Nobody ever reads the good news, or occasionally there might be a good news story, but generally all the bad stuff. So you keep feeling yourself this all the time. What does it do? After a while, it makes you feel it's depressed, yeah, a bit sad. Wow, the world is really a bad place. Actually, the world isn't such a bad place. There's all these good things happening in the world, and this is what we forget. People being kind to each other on a regular basis, people doing good things in the world. It's just that nobody talks about that. This is why a bit of metta meditation is useful to remind you that actually there are a lot of good people in the world of all backgrounds, all religions, doing kind things for each other. What a wonderful thing that is, and how worthy it is of celebrating all that kindness in the world. But otherwise, we get dragged down by all the dodgy stuff. Anyway, so there you are. Oh, I've got to hurry up. Okay, an insight from this. Here I am. One. Should we eat well and exercise regularly, considering Buddhism principle of non-self? Non-self does not mean you should not eat well. Yeah, non-self means still eat well. Because remember, just because there is no self, you are still conditioned by external phenomena. You are conditioned by what you eat. You are what you eat. Quite literally, yeah. This has come about through eating this body. So you are what you eat in a certain way. Yeah. So please eat wisely. Don't think, non-self doesn't matter. Yeah. It doesn't work like that. Yeah. Please exercise a bit as well. It's good to keep your body in reasonably physical health. It is much easier to meditate if your body is in a good condition. If you have a bad shoulder pain, for example, it makes it much more difficult. Yeah, we all know that. So keep your body in reasonable condition. Don't follow Ajahn Brahm too closely in this particular area. In this particular area, I would not recommend to follow Ajahn Brahm. Follow Ajahn Brahm when it comes to meditation, when it comes to being kind and compassionate, all of that. But when it comes to eating habits and exercise habits, maybe not. Remember, Ajahn Brahm is already up there, yeah? Ajahn Brahm doesn't care. If he dies tomorrow, he'll probably be so happy to be out of here. Yeah? For most of us, it isn't like that. We still have more work to be done before we ready to get out of here. So, in certain areas, I would not recommend you to follow Ajahn Brahm. Follow him on the spiritual path, but not so much on the weight-gain path. So please do so. Number two, if we don't suppress our departments through willpower, what if such departments keep occurring? Reaching the precept despite constant reflection. Well, this is the point, yeah? So if the defilements are so strong that it makes you reach the precept, then is the time to use a bit of willpower. Yeah, what I was saying today, if you kind of feel like murdering somebody, please don't murder anyone, yeah? Because if you do, yeah, all this monkey said, yeah, don't suppress your defilements, yeah, so I just went out and murdered somebody, yeah? Then I would make me feel really bad afterwards. So please don't make me feel that bad. Suppress the defilements. If they're really bad and they kind of make you do really bad things, that is the time to use willpower. Yeah? So you're quite right about that. Yeah? Okay, now I'm going to appreciate nice, kind of apple juice for a couple of minutes. Not that long, actually. Okay. Sometimes I hear melodies while meditating. Should I suppress this? Is that the mobile phone going off in Hampstead? Sometimes you hear the mobile phone going off in meditation practice. So. Don't suppress it. Don't suppress anything there. Yeah? Observe it. And as you observe it, it will die down there. If you, the reason why it's there is because you tend to get caught up in the melody. Saying, whoops, I'm hearing this melody here. Once you start observing it, once you have that mindfulness and ability just to see the melody right there, usually it starts to die down already here. Don't force it out. Don't suppress anything here. Just allow the world to be. That is kind of the beginning of meditation practice. Because as you allow the world to be here, mindfulness starts to arise from that. Be the passive observer, be the passenger of the train. What do passengers on the train do? Do they drive the train? No. They just sit back. They look out the window and they see the landscape go by. Yeah? Landscapes, sometimes landscapes include them. Good landscapes, yeah, like a nice melody. Sometimes bad landscapes, yeah, like an angry thought or whatever. But you just allow it to go by. You just observe and you just watch it. And you don't try to drive the train. You are a passenger on the train. Passenger on the bus. Passenger in life. And now in life will flow by. And then, hopefully, mindfulness will arise. And then it will arise. Either way, that is fine. That's in the right way. Okay, here I am. You mentioned that virtue sila is the foundation for samadhi wisdom. Can you take some time to explain further on the ways to purify sila for lay people, and those who wish to go beyond the five precepts? Thank you. Okay, so five precepts are already very useful. They give you a very good guide, and they give you kind of a. The nice thing about them, they're easy to remember, and so you know. When your mind, sometimes in the mind, the defilement is very strong, it is easy to break the precepts because it's just so powerful, yeah? And unless you have clarity about what's going on, unless you remember the five precepts, you haven't got the guidance to stop you sometimes. So this is the nice thing about precepts, it's like a stop sign, it's a stop. But really, what this is all about, it's all about kindness. Yeah, remember, one single word you need to remember is kindness. Once you understand kindness, you understand it's not just about avoiding killing beings. It's actually actively being compassionate to living beings. Yeah, being kind to living beings, helping them out. Not just not killing the mosquito, but kind of, you don't have to feed. If you don't want to feed the mosquito, that's okay. Yeah? Because that really means you have each other towards it. So don't have to maybe feed them, but even with animals, be kind to them when you see them. Be generous. If you have a pet, it's a very good opportunity to be kind to an animal. The people around you, wherever they are, not only be not kind of be nasty to them, but actually be kind to people around you. Be compassionate. Understand that we're all in this world together. We all have much more suffering in our lives than we want. Yeah, is there anyone here who has too little suffering? Can't imagine, nobody has too little suffering. It's completely unheard of. Everybody has too much suffering in their lives. Why? Because they have family members who die. They have all of this kind of thing. The daily grind of life often can be not very nice. So when you see other people do bad things, speak in bad ways, act badly, remember the reason why they do that is very often because they have suffering in their life. So when we see bad actions, remember, compassion is the right way to look at somebody who's acting in a bad way. It's always the right approach. But instead of stealing, we are generous to other people. Take every opportunity to be kind and generous. Yeah, whenever you have the opportunity, there are so many opportunities when you start looking out for them. And I was saying that just in traffic, just when you're driving, you can either be kind or nasty to the people around you. Kind, you can let someone in. Yeah. Or whatever it is. And not many people do that. If you can be one of the few who does that, wow, what a wonderful thing that is. Not just not lying. Lying is the precept, for right speech in the five precepts. Not only do you not lie, but you actually actively tell the truth. Yeah, you try to be as truthful as possible. Not only do you, the other factors of speech, and speech is often very difficult. The other factor of bad speech is that one speech is divisive speech. you know, dividing people from each other, saying bad things to one person about somebody else. Whenever you say something bad about somebody else another, you are essentially splitting those people apart because they're getting a bad impression of each other. Right? Instead, you unify them. Instead, you explain, oh, we're going through a difficult time. It was difficult for them to be kind because of that, whatever it is. By explaining and making people understand, we bring people together. We create friendships. We create harmony in the world. And creating harmony is a very powerful, you know, way of making good karma. Making people like each other, be positive around each other. You know, the saying, what is like one of the really bad karmas is to create a schism in the monastic order. Because why? Well, because I'm dividing the monastic order. It's a kind of divisive speech. But creating harmony in the monastic order is a very strong, positive karma. So being one who creates harmony in the world, who creates kind of good feeling among the people, and then that is the right monastic divine speech. Speak gently, don't speak harshly. Speak words that are wise and useful to people. Instead of just gossiping, we're talking about the final chapter of all of this. And there is the one about sensuality. Well, that, you know, the kama is vicharachara, and that just basically means, you know, sticking to your partner in life and not messing around. That's really what that means. If you want to take that to a higher level, then especially when you become a monastic, you can live a celibate life. Some lay people are not living a celibate life as lay people. It's possible, if you are really committed to Buddhist teachings, it can be done as well. But it's not really required. It's not a very, very important part of this. What else is there? And there's alcohol, of course, which is very useful to overcome. But generally, remember, all you really need to remember to summarize all this, you need to remember kindness. From moment to moment to moment, day after day, week after week, year in and year out, lifetimes, this lifetime, and also perhaps future lifetimes, if you're still around. So that helps a little bit. Then it will serve, if we get an itch or feel discomfort during meditation, should we scratch it or adjust our posture? I would say, yes, it's okay to scratch an itch, it depends how persistent it is, especially if it is persistent, it's okay to scratch the itch. Some itches are perhaps not worth scratching. If it is a mosquito bite, sometimes you scratch and it gets worse. You get more itchy, you end up itching again. So sometimes you can try a little bit of discipline and kind of hold back from that. But even if you have a mosquito bite, if you itch a little bit, I don't think there is any problem with scratching the itch. If you feel discomfort during meditation, there is different levels of discomfort. There is always a little bit of discomfort. Before this, it's hardly ever absolutely happy, except when you get into deep meditation. So there's only a little bit of discomfort. Don't worry so much about it. But if you see that it is something that is a little bit persistent, the mind goes back to it all the time, that is the right time to change your posture. So again, you have to find that balance. But I think it's better to err on the side of being comfortable, err on the side of changing your posture. So please change your posture. It's allowable. And if you make a little bit of noise, that's okay. You will have compassion on you. You will think they are suffering, they have changed the posture, okay, compassion for that person. This is what I like. Sometimes you have people snoring in a meditation mode. And I really like that because you really got to relax. You have to be able to snore while people are meditating around you. And that's kind of cool. So I always have compassion for those people who can really relax and really snore. There's a famous story, Ajahn Brahm, I don't know if it's true, but that Ajahn Brahm story, that would be exaggerated sometimes. But Ajahn Brahm had this story, that he was in a monastery in Thailand somewhere, and there was this monk who was giving a Dhamma talk. And in the middle of the Dhamma talk, he is giving the talk, he falls asleep while giving the talk. Imagine, you've got to be pretty chilled, sitting there talking and then he wakes up after about 15 minutes, then he continues the talk exactly where he left off. I think that's really nice because it means you're so relaxed while you're giving the talk, really, really chilled. And it was kind of nice. But it may also have been an illness. You know, an illness that people have when they fall asleep at kind of random times. So it could have been that as well, but I'm not sure exactly what it is. Or should we observe the rising and passing away of such bodily sensations? Thank you. I'm not sure what is to be gained, to be honest, by observing the rising and passing away of this phenomenon. I hear people always talking about that. You can try. I'm not sure if there's much to be gained from that. What we are trying to do is to deepen our clarity of mind and deepen our stillness. And so, very often, you are just stopping yourself, rocking yourself, and deepening the stillness by observing pain like that. My experience doesn't get you very far. You can observe pain at some stage, but that will be much later in meditation when the stillness is much more profound. And usually at that point, all the pain is gone anyway because the body has kind of faded into the background. The Buddha doesn't actually say anywhere that we should specifically focus on the arising and passing away of pain. I don't think it is required, but better to bypass the whole pain thing, just go straight to happiness. Yeah, isn't that much more cool than the state of happiness? And then you contemplate the happiness instead. What do you want to do? Want to put happiness or contemplate pain? Yeah, I know what I prefer. And what is so interesting, this is what we will see in the Anapanasati Sutta, this is exactly what the Buddha says in the Anapanasati Sutta. The first part of Anapanasati is divided into 16 steps. The first four steps are equivalent to body contemplation, Kaya Nupasana, of the Satipatthana Sutta. The second four steps of Anapanasati, which all are about happy states of mind, Hiti, Sukha, all that kind of stuff, that is equivalent to the Vedana Vipassana, the contemplation of healing. Yeah, all you have to do, according to the Buddha, is contemplate happy feelings, and you are fulfilling the Vedana Vipassana of Satipatthana. That's all you have to do. You don't have to watch pain in the body. Yeah, it's not necessary. Yeah. So, for that reason, I would say, skip it. Go straight to madness. Anyway, look. Yeah, okay. We are living in a gender diversity world. How does Buddhism react to this matter? And do LGBTs? LGBTs can all fashion that. We have all this other LGBTI and Q, and I don't know what else it goes on there. It's in the city, to a certain point. And do LGBT people succeed in this practice both as lay and monastics? Yes, they succeeded. I know quite a few people who are, what you might call, gender diverse, also in monastic life, and certainly in lay life. And there is no problem. They succeed. It all depends on the defilements of the mind and your ability to practice the path. Yeah? Whether you have any of these kind of inclinations kind of irrelevant. So there is no problem there. And I think the Buddhist reaction to this matter, that Buddhism doesn't really care so much about all of these things. Yeah? Whether you have one inclination or another one is not actually what it is about. In Buddhism, what it is about is whether you are kind or not. You have a good heart. That is what Buddhism is about. If you are a kind person, all of these other stuff is kind of irrelevant. Yeah, so that's why you see people with good hearts, they always get good meditation, regardless of their sexual inclination or anything else. Good meditation is still available to people like that. And as long as they are able to live with the celibate lifestyle, they are, as far as we're concerned, in Perth anyway, they are welcome to ordain in our monasteries down there. Of course, you have to be able to live in that kind of community in a good way, otherwise it becomes impossible. The answer to that is yes. I know some people who are, you know, gays or lesbians who get very, very good meditation. It's just that there is no blockage at all from this kind of thing. Okay. I'm going to answer quite briefly because I'm going to finish multiple questions. Here I said, even if we don't slaughter animals, it doesn't even need make us guilty of breaking the first precept, even if it's indirectly. Increased consumption of meat is to more killing. No, I'm not a vegetarian. Okay, thank you. Okay, are you breaking the first precept indirectly? And I think the answer is no, you are not. And the reason I can say that is because the Buddha also admitted. Yeah? We know that from the Sutta that the Buddha also admitted. Obviously, he kept the first three centers because that is part of the Patimokkha Sila of monastics. Yeah? So it's not the same thing. They are different things. Killing actually means literally killing. Buying meat is a different thing. Yes, you can argue that perhaps you are supporting the meat industry a little bit, but you're not actually killing an animal. It is that intention to kill which is really the main problem with this precept. Increased consumption of meat leads to more killing. Yes, that is true. When people want to be vegetarians, I always encourage that. I try to be vegetarian myself to resist that. And when I come here to the BJF, you don't have to feed me meat. Yeah? Usually in a monastery in Perth, I eat vegetarian food. Huh? So you're more than welcome just to serve a vegetarian food if you'd like to do that. But I'm not fussy. I tend to be quite flexible because I know that at the monastic you can't really demand exactly what you're going to eat. So I think being vegetarian is good. And I think that especially in the modern world where we have all this factory farming, the terrible treatment of animals that actually goes on. The more you know about it, the more disgusted you are with how animals are treated in the world. And the more kind of natural it is, I think, it is to become a vegetarian when you see that. If you have a little bit of compassion for animals, it kind of makes sense. So I think it's a good thing to do, but it's not an absolute requirement. And I don't think anyone should be kind of treated harshly or whatever just because they prefer to eat meat. But if you want to be vegetarian, good on you. I would certainly support you in that. Vinyasa, would excessive willpower to meditate impede the progress of meditation? Yes, it would impede the progress. And especially in the long run, you may get some short-term benefits from that. But in the long run, it's better to learn to relax and just enjoy and just kind of allow things to arise on their own, rather than trying to force it into existence. What do we watch during walking meditation? The steps or the breath? Walking meditation, you can watch almost anything. You can use all the kind of various meditation objects that you also use during a sitting meditation. You can watch the breath if that's possible, but it can be quite hard to watch the breath during walking meditation. So some people instead watch the feet. It's a much stronger impression usually. Yeah? But you don't have to do any of that. You can do metta meditation. Yeah, you can do contemplations while you're walking. Because while you're walking, the mind is more active. So it's easier to do contemplations while you're walking. You can think about the suttas we have been talking about. Yeah, you think, is that interesting? You learn off some of those things in your own mind. Another thing you can do when you're walking meditation is just to chill. Yeah, just walk back and forth on anything at all. Just enjoy walking, just enjoy the peace, just enjoy being here. After a while, sitting for a long time, it's almost as if you just need to move a little bit. So you just move a little bit. This was one of the Burmese monks who I remember, Uchetaniya, a well-known Burmese monk. Comes to Perth with Kaitanina. And that's how he teaches walking meditation. Just walk back and forth, but don't do anything in particular. Just enjoy the peace. Just relax. If anything, just get to know yourself. Yeah? See what your mind does. Walk back and forth. See where your mind happens to go. And then learn something about yourself. What are your problems? What are the things that you need to deal with? Yeah? And then you can use that to contemplate later on. Contemplate how to see certain people in a positive way. Yeah. So you can do all kinds of stuff in walking meditation. You don't have to do anything in particular. Yeah. Sometimes just relax, just enjoy, just walk back and forth, and just have a good time. Especially if you feel a bit tense. Yeah? If you feel a bit tense, maybe you haven't watched the breath too hard or something, using too much willpower, just chill afterwards. Yeah? Something like that? Yeah. Anyway, there isn't any kind of absolute recipe. It's interesting when you see that at the time of the Buddha, they would often go chankama. Chankama is the Pali word for walking meditation. And often you could see that they were walking up and down and they would contemplate something or something like that. They never said that they would watch the breath or anything. In fact, watching the breath, if you read the Anapanasati Sutta, he said at the very beginning, you sit down. That's really a sitting down meditation. Okay, so this. Oh, this person has sign from we're confused. We met that confusion. So if we give you a party name, we will give you that name. Confused. So if you want to see me later, I'll give you that party name so you can live up to your signature here. Anyway, here I am. I am confused for metta meditation. Are we supposed to radiate to our near and dear ones? In one of Ajahn Brahm's guided metta, he said, choose the closest person or partner to oneself and infuse the person with metta. Will we be more attached? Well, the teacher said we can't radiate to our partners. Please advise and guide the metta from confused. We call you a mohaka, the confused one. So, there are different ways of doing it. Yeah? And it is really, again, you have to experiment with it and see what works for you. And I tend to agree, I think sometimes if you radiate the people who are too close to you, it can lead to more attachment. It is not really the cool kind of metta that is kind of unattached to the whole world. And it kind of leads to a bit more clingy kind of state of things. But look at your mind and see what happens to you. Does it work for you or not? And what is actually the best thing for you to do? And then you will find out what works. And some people like to do it, I like to do it towards nobody in particular, just the direction. Other people prefer to do it to people. So if you do it to people, then I think that one of the best things is to do it to someone who is really neutral in your life. Yeah, someone who you are neither too close to nor too far away from, but somebody you have a very positive perception about. Yeah? I don't know who that might be. Maybe Ajahn Brahm? Yeah? Do to Ajahn Brahm. Start with him. Is that works. Yeah, he's got a lot of good qualities. Or someone else, a teacher, yeah, someone who's a little bit further away, but who you have a lot of kind of sympathy and see a lot of good qualities in, yeah? And then you can start like that too. But the main thing about metta is that you have the ability to see the good qualities in that person. If you can see the good qualities in somebody, that is when you can have metta. That's why whenever you start with the enemy comes kind of last. Yeah? You start with all the people who have good secret qualities in. That's why I say at the beginning, bring up the perception of good qualities. Bring up the perception of generosity. What does generosity mean as a felt experience? Yeah? Kindness, what does it mean as a felt experience? And then you remember that a lot of people in the world actually had this felt experience of kindness and generosity. Yeah, they had it often, and they act on that. What a wonderful thing it is. And then you see all the people in the world with all of these wonderful qualities, and then you're able to wish them well, because you see the qualities of these people. So it is not, you know, with many of these things, there isn't any necessarily right way of doing it. But there is whatever really works for you. But what is interesting, when you read the sutta, the way the Buddha talks about radiated metta, he doesn't really talk about using it to individuals. He talks about doing it to, you know, two or four directions. So, we're going to have a look at this soon, I think, but the way the Buddha often talks about metta, he talks about metta often on a very basic level towards individuals. So when we are kind to each other, by body, speech and mind, we have metta for each other. Yeah, that's already metta. So when you meet people in your daily life, you think kind thoughts about them. Yeah, this is how you have metta towards people in your daily life. This is how you have metta towards your family. You don't have to radiate it now, but in your daily life, you think kind thoughts. So you remember to have compassion, you remember all these positive things. And as you do that, you are practicing the foundation that enables you to do the metta meditation very often. Metta in daily life, in our actions, speech and thought, is the foundation for all other metta later on. And have a look at the sutta afterwards. In a couple of days, and then tomorrow, how that actually works out. Okay, last question for this evening. Dear Ajahn, how to get along with my loneliness when I'm always finding someone besides me all the time? Thank you. Okay, so how to deal with loneliness? So, one of the strange things that I always notice of being a Buddhist monk, I spend a lot of time by myself, yeah? I have a little hut in the forest, it's just me and the kangaroo and a few mosquitoes and a few ticks and that kind of stuff. But actually, I don't really feel lonely. Yeah. And I always find it so surprising because I know that a lot of people, if I were a lay person in a similar kind of situation, I might very well feel lonely. But I don't really ever feel lonely as a monk. And you realize that is because of your attitude to your loneliness. Yeah, you feel that being alone actually is a positive thing. I can develop my mind. I can use it in a good way. So use that if you aren't by yourself, if you aren't alone, see it as a blessing. See it as a possibility to do something good. Yeah, to do something different. When you are by yourself, you can read what you like, you can listen to what you like, you can do what you like. You don't have to worry about what anyone else thinks. If you want to meditate, you can meditate. If you want to listen to the Dhamma talk, you can have a Dhamma talk. And there's no arguments with yourself, yeah? What a wonderful thing that is, no arguments. Hey, it's just by myself. Unless you are really argumentative and you argue with yourself, yeah? Not so common. So, lots of benefits. So, remember, when you are alone, it actually is a wonderful opportunity to practice the Dhamma, to practice the Buddhist teachings. Listen, there are so many good, nice Dhamma talks now available on the internet. There are so many good translations of the suttas available on the internet. Read some of those suttas, inspire yourself, and then do some meditation practice by yourself. And when you do that, you start to feel less lonely as a consequence. Another thing you can do is to find some good Buddhist groups around you, yeah? And like, for example, in Perth, we have the Buddhist Society of WA. You can go there to listen to talks, you can hang out with like-minded people a little bit. So find some Buddhist group which kind of has like-minded people, people who live well. I'm not saying that we should do this just to practice religion as such. I don't really consider Buddhism to be a religion, even necessarily, depending on how you look at it. Just to live well, and to be able to live well, it's so important to have Kalyanamitta in your life. People who support you, people around you, who can actually help you out for these things. So loneliness is all in the perception. It's all about how we look at things. Look at things in the right way, it is no problem. It's like Ajahn Brahm always says, yeah, if I were put in prison, I'd be so happy. If I would be in prison, I would kind of do something really bad, so it would be solitary confinement. You know, it's such a big thing to be in solitary confinement. Nobody can talk to you, nobody can bother you, nobody can relax. What is the difference between a monastery and a prison? The only difference is that the conditions are not the same as the more meals and you have TV, you don't even have that in the monastery. So in some ways, conditions exist, not actually in the monastery. The main difference between prison and a monastery, in a monastery you don't go voluntarily. In prison you go involuntarily. Yeah? And that is a massive difference. It is a complete difference in perception. Of course, okay, it also matters that your friends in the monastery are a little bit better than the friends in prison. Okay, let's face it. And prison friends are not the best ones. But basically, it has to do with whether we do it voluntarily or not. So if you have the feeling that you are lonely, it's because you don't really want to be lonely. But if you are lonely voluntarily, if you choose to be in solitude, you actually change your entire perception and you make it your choice instead of making it something that is imposed upon you. If you feel it is imposed upon you, you feel lonely. If it is your choice, loneliness doesn't evaporate. It's not a problem. So spend the time wisely. See if there's something you can do. Just volunteer, yeah? Volunteer in your life to help other people out who are in a more difficult situation than you. If you do that, you are creating a good karma. You start to feel good about yourself because you are actually helping people out who are having a difficult life. It's act of generosity on your part. So find ways of spending your time wisely and loneliness gets kind of banished by that. Don't stay in the monastery for a while, yeah? And learn how to be lonely. If you want to come down to Perth, stay in my monastery, go to Dhammasara, stay there for a while, and just chill in the little room. And I promise you, you probably won't feel lonely at all, because now you're supposed to be lonely, and actually it feels quite nice. Okay, enough. So, that is all for tonight. So please have a nice rest. Thank you for joining us for 6:30. And in the meantime, let's just take a moment to look at the camera.